sperm whales, see Carl Zimmer's At the Water's Edge, pages 219 to 226. Richard Ellis in Men and Whales also speaks eloquently about a sperm whale's brain, page 29. Hal Whitehead and Linda Weilgart in Moby's Click talk about how whales use clicks both for echolocation and communication. They tell of sperm whales being known as carpenter fish, page 64. Linda Weilgart, Hal Whitehead, and Catherine Payne write about the remarkable similarities between sperm whales and elephants in A Colossal Convergence. The description of the battle between the two bull sperm whales is in Caldwell et al., pages 692 to 693. In Henry Carlyle's novel The Jonah Man, Pollard theorizes that the whale herd chases hammering through the air. Carried on the easterly wind, the clatter of hammers could be heard more than a mile to westward, page 106. But, as Whitehead confirms in a personal email communication, the sperm whale would have most likely heard the hammering through the water, the medium to which its ears were best adapted and which transmits sounds with a much greater efficiency than air. In fact, the whale that attacked the Essex would have also heard the chaos being wreaked by Pollard and Joy in the shoal of sperm whales, several miles to leeward. While this might seem to corroborate Chase's belief that the whale was fired with revenge for their sufferings, Whitehead points out that it is important to understand that we now know that relationships between large male sperm whales and groups of females are brief and impermanent. Thus, it is very unlikely that the male had any attachment to the females being killed. Personal Communication, August 5, 1998. Whitehead theorizes that the whale may have first struck the Essex by mistake, and that this contact greatly disturbed the animal, resulting in the second event, which does read like an attack. Personal Communication, August 5, 1998. Many whalemen in the 19th century apparently agreed with Whitehead. According to a remark concerning the Essex from the North American Review, cited by Francis Olmsted in Incidents of a Whaling Voyage, but no other instance is known in which the mischief is supposed to have been malignantly designed by the assailant, the whale, and most experienced whalers believe that even in this case, the attack was not intentional. Page 145. Other whalemen, however, thought differently. An old Nantucket captain in William H. Macy's There She Blows states, "We have all heard of the Essex affair. I remember it well, for I was cruising on Chile at that time in the Plutarch, and from the statements of the survivors it is plain enough that the whale went to work deliberately and with malice prepense, as the lawyers would say, to destroy the ship." Page 133. My description of how the Essex was constructed is based on several sources. John Currier, in Historical Sketch of Shipbuilding on the Merrimack River, claims that ships constructed in Amesbury at the time of the Essex were built almost entirely of oak, their decks alone being of native white pine. The ribs, planking, ceiling, beams, and knees were cut from oak timber, floated down the river or drawn by ox teams from within a radius of 10 or 15 miles. Page 34. My thanks to Roger Hambridge and Ted Kay of Mystic Seaport for directing me to a specifications list of the whale ship Hector in Albert Cook Church's Whale Ships and Whaling, pages 174 to 179. Thanks also to Mark Starr at the Shipyard Documentation Office of Mystic Seaport for providing me with the specifications of the Charles W. Morgan. I also relied on Reginald Hegarty's Birth of a Whale Ship. My thanks to Professor Ted Dukas of the Physics Department at Wellesley College for speaking to me about the physics of whales in general and the wreck of the Essex in particular. My thanks also to Peter Smith, a naval architect at Hinckley Yachts, who calculated the potential forces involved in a collision between an 80-ton whale and a 238-ton ship, and the strength of a whale ship's construction. Personal Communications, December 18th and 23rd, 1998. Chapter 6, The Plan. In Survival Psychology, John Leach writes of the apathy that commonly affects survivors in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, known as the recoil period, pages 24 to 37 and 129 to 134. In Disaster, Effects of Mental and Physical State, Warren Kinston and Rachel Rosser discuss the reluctance of survivors to leave the scene of a disaster, page 444. Concerning whaleboats in the early 19th century, Eric Ronberg Jr. states, "Depictions of boats from this period, in the form of paintings, lithographs, and logbook sketches, make it clear that rowing was the usual, if not exclusive, form of propulsion. Those sources that do show whaleboats under sail indicate that the sprit rig was most favored, and the boats were guided with a steering oar with no rudder in evidence. This, compounded by the lack of a centerboard, would have severely handicapped the boat's abilities to sail to windward. Indeed, this rig and steering configuration would be efficient only in the pursuit of whales downwind." To Build a Whaleboat, page 1. As Ronberg also points out, these early boats were of clinker or lapstrake construction, not the batten seam construction that typified boats in later years. Instead of being white, as were almost all whaleboats by the middle of the 19th century, the Essex boats were probably quite colorful, perhaps dark blue and red, the color of the ship's flag. See Ansel, page 95. Caleb Crane's Lovers of Human Flesh, Homosexuality and Cannibalism in Melville's Novels contains an excellent synopsis of early 19th century accounts of Marquesan cannibalism and homosexuality, page 30. For a discussion of the kinds of stories about native cannibalism that were told by the seamen of the era, see Gnanith Obiesekir's Cannibal Feasts in 19th Century Fiji, Seamen's Yarns and the Ethnographic Imagination, in Cannibalism and the Colonial World, edited by Francis Barker, Peter Holm, and Margaret Iverson. There was also a disturbing racial aspect to the rumors of cannibalism that sailors swapped in the forecastles of whale ships. A Maori chief from New Zealand who had been brought to London in 1818 insisted that black men had a much more agreeable flavor than white, in Tannehill's Flesh and Blood, page 151. Suggesting that this was accepted as a fact among Nantucket whalemen was the experience of Captain Benjamin Worth off the coast of New Zealand in 1805. Worth told of how, when a gale threatened to drive his ship ashore, the blacks in the crew begged him to do everything he could to make for open ocean, since the natives preferred Negro flesh to that of the white man. In Stackpole's The Sea Hunters, pages 399 to 400. The officers of the Essex were between voyages when the stories about the peaceful state of the natives of Nuka Hiva appeared in the New Bedford Mercury, April 28, 1819. Melville's statement about the Essex crew's decision to gain a civilized harbor is part of the comments he wrote in the back pages of his own copy of Chase's narrative, a transcript of which is included in the Northwestern Newbery edition of Moby Dick, pages 978 to 995. Ernest Dodge, in Islands and Empires, speaks of the gigantic Royal Mission Chapel in Tahiti built in 1819, the same year the Essex left Nantucket, page 91. Obed Macy's remarks about the Nantucketers' intimate knowledge of the sea is in his History, page 213. Such was not, apparently, the case when it came to the land masses of the world. William Comstock recounts an incident that reveals just how geographically ignorant a Nantucketer could be. At one point, the officer of a Nantucket whale ship very honestly desired to be informed whether England was on the continent or stood alone by itself, and on being answered by another officer that it was in the county of Great Britain, wanted to know how far it was from London. The Life of Samuel Comstock, page 57. If a whaleman could be this vague about an island with which Nantucket had always had a close commercial connection, it is little wonder that the men of the Essex were without any information concerning the islands of the Central Pacific. For a detailed drawing of the launch Captain Bligh and his men sailed to the island of Timor, see A. Richard Mansier's edition of Bligh's The Journal of Bounty's Launch. Leach, in Survival Psychology, discusses the differences between authoritarian and social leaders, page 140, while Glyn Bennett, in Beyond Endurance, Survival at the Extremes, speaks of the different personality types required in what he calls the escape and survival periods following a disaster, pages 210 to 211. The analysis of a career first mate versus a fishy man is based on William H. Macy's words about the first mate, Grafton, whom Macy describes as a man of rather thoughtful cast of mind, of much intelligence, and possessed of an extensive stock of information upon many subjects, with a habit of generalizing and a clearness of expression which rendered him an agreeable companion to all with whom he came in contact. Though a good whaleman, Grafton, the first mate, was not what is known to the connoisseur as a fishy man. Pages 44 to 45. John Leach in Survival Psychology writes about the importance family connections take on during a disaster, page 156, as well as the relationship of strong leadership to survival, page 139. Chapter 7. At Sea. See Ronberg's To Build a Whaleboat for an excellent analysis of the difficulties of sailing an early 19th century whaleboat, pages 1 through 4. Concerning the sound made by a clinker-style whaleboat, Clifford Ashley writes in The Yankee Whaler, "The name of clinker was formed in imitation of the sound made by the boat while going through water. I have frequently noted this in a clinker-built tender. As the whale grew wary, later in the 19th century, the noise was found objectionable, and therefore a smooth-sided boat, to glide more silently upon the unsuspecting animal, was adopted." Page 61. Ashley records the location of the offshore ground as latitude 5 degrees to 10 degrees south, longitude 105 degrees to 125 degrees west. Page 41. Thomas Heffernan has identified at least 7 whale ships that were in the neighborhood of the Essex at the sinking. 3 from Nantucket, the Governor Strong, the Thomas, and the Globe, 3 from New Bedford, the Balaena, the Persia, the Golconda, and 1 from England, the Coquette, page 77. For information on hardtack, see Sandra Oliver's Saltwater Foodways, page 107. The nutritional content of the hardtack rations and Galapagos tortoises, as well as the estimate of how much weight the men would lose over the course of 60 days, were determined with the help of Beth Tornovich and Dr. Timothy Lepore on Nantucket. Statistics relating to the body's water needs come from Understanding Normal and Clinical Nutrition by Eleanor Whitney et al., pages 272 to 275. As a point of comparison, Captain Bligh set his men's initial daily rations at 1 ounce of bread, as opposed to 6 ounces for the men of the Essex, and a quarter pint compared to a half pint of water. Bounty's Launch, page 36. Francis Olmsted observed that many of the crew aboard the whale ship on which he sailed had laid in from 50 to 70 pounds of tobacco as their solace for the voyage, and will probably have to obtain a fresh supply from the captain before they return home. Pages 83 to 84. Warren Kinston and Rachel Rosser speak of the effects of a tormenting memory and cite William James's reference to the San Francisco earthquake in Disaster, Effects on Mental and Physical State, pages 443 to 444. Hilda Blum in How Did They Survive? Mechanisms of Defense in Nazi Concentration Camps speaks of the importance of self-expression in promoting psychic survival, page 10. John Leach in Survival Psychology refers to activities such as Lawrence's creation of a piece of twine as tasking, which he defines as the breaking down of the person's aim or purpose into simple tasks so that life can be handled one step at a time, page 152. He refers to one subject who dealt with a particularly long-term situation by making himself a rudimentary set of golf clubs and wooden balls, page 153. My discussion of navigation is based in large part on J.B. Hewson's A History of the Practice of Navigation, especially his chapter on navigation by latitude and dead reckoning, pages 178 to 225. Francis Olmsted, in Incidents of a Whaling Voyage, also provides an interesting account of navigation on a whaleship, pages 43 to 44. My thanks to Donald Truergy of Mystic Seaport for sharing his expertise with me. According to Truergy in a personal communication, if Pollard of the Essex did not learn to work a lunar until the next voyage, it seems very unlikely that he would have had a chronometer for doing a time sight in 1819. Marine chronometers in 1819 were still handmade, costly, and not always reliable. According to Obed Macy, who speaks of Nantucket's whaling captains being lunarians in his history, by the 1830s, the island's whale ships were generally furnished with chronometers, page 218. On Captain Bligh's remarkable feat of navigation in an open boat, see Bounty's Launch, pages 24 and 60 to 61. In his history, Obed Macy tells how the crew of the Union tied their 2 whaleboats together, page 233. In Survive the Savage Sea, Dougal Robertson recounts how his wooden sailing yacht was rammed repeatedly and sunk by several killer whales. Robert Pittman and Susan Chivers describe how a pod of killer whales attacked and killed a sperm whale in Terror in Black and White, Natural History, December 1998, pages 26 to 28. The description of Chase's dissection of a tortoise is based in part on Dougal Robertson's detailed account of cutting up a green turtle, page 109. Chase calls the conditions they experienced on December 8th as a perfect gale. Dean King's A Sea of Words defines gale as a wind of an intensity between that of a strong breeze and a storm. In the 19th century, it was more precisely defined as blowing at a speed of between 28 and 55 nautical miles per hour. In a gale, the waves are high with crests that break into spindrift, while in a strong gale, the crests topple and roll and dense streaks of foam blow in the wind. Page 202. Richard Hubbard's Boaters Bowditch, The Small Craft American Practical Navigator, includes a table that puts the theoretical maximum of waves with unlimited fetch in Force 9, 41 to 47 knots, at 40 feet. Page 312. William Van Dorn's Oceanography and Seamanship also includes a useful table that indicates the rate of sea state growth as a function of wind speed and duration. Page 189. John Leach speaks of the perceptual narrowing that occurs in the aftermath of a disaster, page 124, a factor that undoubtedly contributed to the Essex survivors' unswerving commitment to their original plan, even though heading for the Society Islands remained a possibility throughout the first month after the sinking. Chapter 8. Centering Down. The best accounts of the sufferings of the people aboard the Medusa raft are from two of the survivors, J.B. Henri Savigny and Alexander Coriard, in Narrative of a Voyage to Senegal. See also Alexander McKee's Death Raft. W.J. McGee's analysis of the sufferings of Pablo Valencia in the southwestern Arizona desert appears in his now-famous article, Desert Thirst as Disease. My description of gooseneck barnacles is based on information provided by James Carlton, director of the Williams Mystic Program at Mystic Seaport. Personal Communication, October 1998. For a description of how the crustaceans are commonly eaten, see the Epicurious Dictionary, www.condenet.com. My thanks to James McKenna on the faculty of the Williams Mystic Program for providing me with detailed information on why some portions of the Pacific support less life than others. Personal Communication, March 23, 1999. M.F. Mowry's chart indicating the desolate region appears in Plate 5 of his wind and current charts. Willits Ansell, in The Whaleboat, tells how to clench a nail, pages 88 to 89. W. Jeffrey Bolster discusses the blacks' spiritual leadership aboard a ship in Blackjacks, page 125. He also recounts the story of the black cooks praying for the deliverance of a whale ship. My description of how Quakers centered down is based on Arthur Worrall's Quakers in the Colonial Northeast, pages 91 to 95. For an excellent summary of the effects of starvation on disaster victims, see John Leach's Survival Psychology, pages 87 to 99. Throughout their narratives, Chase and Nickerson occasionally contradict themselves concerning the amount of water and especially bread rations. In this and other chapters, I have assumed that the downward progression of their daily rations of bread was from 6 ounces to 3 ounces, and finally, after leaving Henderson Island, to 1.5 ounces, while the daily water ration remained at half a pint. Chapter 9. The Island. For an account of the Nantucketer Mayhew Folger's discovery of Pitcairn Island, see Greg Denning's Mr. Bligh's Bad Language, pages 307 to 338, and Walter Hayes's The Captain from Nantucket and the Mutiny on the Bounty, pages 41 to 47. To this day, Pitcairners rely on miro and tau wood harvested at Henderson to produce the wood carvings they sell to tourists. See D. Burkitt's Serpent in Paradise for a description of a modern-day wood-collecting voyage from Pitcairn to Henderson, pages 81 to 96. From 1991 to 1992, a team of scientists under the aegis of the Sir Peter Scott Commemorative Expedition to the Pitcairn Islands set up a base camp on the north beach of Anderson Island, almost exactly where the Essex survivors landed more than 170 years earlier. The scientists flew to Tahiti, then sailed the 2,000 miles to Henderson on a chartered yacht. Supplies of food and water were shipped in every 3 months from Auckland, New Zealand. I've relied heavily on the book the expedition produced, The Pitcairn Islands, Biogeography, Ecology, and Prehistory, edited by Tim Benton and Tom Spencer, for information about Henderson Island. The presence of a freshwater lens beneath a coral island is discussed in William Thomas's The Variety of Physical Environments Among Pacific Islands, in Man's Place in the Island Ecosystem, a symposium, edited by F.R. Fosberg, pages 26 to 27. Thomas Heffernan cites Robert McLaughlin's account of the medical examination of the skeletons on Henderson Island in Stove by a Whale, pages 84 to 85. The behavior between the man-of-war hawks and tropic birds can still be observed on Henderson Island. See J.A. Vickery and M.D.L. Brooks' The Kleptoparasitic Interactions Between Great Frigate Birds and Masked Boobies on Henderson Island, South Pacific, in The Condor. Although a great frigate bird is another name for a man-of-war hawk, a masked booby is a different species from a tropic bird, the kind of bird Nickerson claimed to have seen on Henderson. T.G. Benton and T. Spencer describe how flora and fauna spread throughout the Pacific Islands in biogeographic processes at the limits of the Indo-West Pacific Province in the Pitcairn Islands, pages 243 to 244. My account of human habitation on Henderson is indebted to T. Spencer and T.G. Benton's Man's Impact on the Pitcairn Islands, pages 375 to 376, and Marshall Weisler's Henderson Island Prehistory, Colonization and Extinction on a Remote Polynesian Island, also in the Pitcairn Islands, pages 377 to 404. In Obesity in Samoans and a Perspective on Its Etiology in Polynesians, in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Stephen McGarvey writes, Polynesian settlement required long ocean voyages into prevailing trade winds and unknown waters. The sailors on these early voyages of indeterminate length and unclear destinations may have experienced a significant risk of starvation and death when on board food supplies dwindled and ceased. Overweight individuals and/or those with efficient metabolisms, presumably mediated by hyperinsulinemia, may have better survived such voyages because of their large store of energy reserves in the form of adipose tissue. Surviving sailors of these discovery voyages and, thus, the first settlers may have been those able to use and store food energy efficiently, perhaps via thrifty genotype mechanisms. Page 1592-S. McGarvey theorizes that this is why modern-day Samoans are characterized by massive adiposity and high prevalence of obesity. See also his article, The Thrifty Gene Concept and Adiposity Studies in Biological Anthropology. When it comes to the men in the Essex whaleboats, McGarvey postulates in a personal communication, May 11, 1999, that the health and nutrition of the men before the whale attack, not any racial or genetic predisposition, were the primary factors influencing their ability to survive. The statistics concerning the relative lifespans of black and white infants are from Barbara M. Dixon's Good Health for African Americans, page 27. Pollard's public letter left on Henderson was quoted from in the Sydney Gazette, June 9, 1821. Other accounts claim that Owen Chase also left a letter. One source says it was addressed to his wife, another to his brother. As extra protection, Pollard placed the letters in a small lead case before putting them in a wooden box nailed to the tree. Chapter 10. The Whisper of Necessity. Statistical information on wind directions in trade wind zones comes from William Thomas's The Variety of Physical Environments Among Pacific Islands, in Man's Place in the Island Ecosystem, edited by F.R. Fosberg, page 31. My thanks to the Nantucket Quaker expert Robert Leach for providing me with information on Matthew Joy's background. Personal communication, May 28, 1998. According to Aaron Paddock's letter, based on Pollard's account and at the NHA, Matthew P. Joy, second officer, died through debility and costiveness. The findings of the Minnesota Starvation Experiment are contained in the two-volume Biology of Human Starvation, by Ansel Keys et al. A readable summary and analysis of the findings are contained in Harold Gutzkow and Paul Bowman's Men and Hunger, a psychological manual for relief workers, a guide still in use today. The term stomach masturbation is referred to by Hilda Bloom in How Did They Survive, page 20. Gutzkow and Bowman speak of starvation and so-called American characteristics in Men and Hunger, page 9. One example of the claims made for dehydration and starvation as a natural and quite tolerable way to die can be found on the website www.asap-care.com/fluids.htm. Dehydration and starvation have proven to be very tolerable while dying. This is easy to understand because people have been dying comfortably for thousands of years without artificial tube feedings and fluid supports. These are natural events that should be allowed to occur when death is imminent, not fought relentlessly and avoided at any and all costs. Chapter 11, Games of Chance. Chase's narrative and Aaron Paddock's letter disagree slightly concerning the timing of events on Pollard's and Hendrick's boats after their separation from Chase. Since Paddock wrote his letter on the night of Pollard's rescue after listening to the captain's own account, I've taken it to be a more reliable source concerning the sequence of events on these two boats. The reference to survival cannibalism at sea being so widespread in the 19th century is from Brian Simpson's Cannibalism and the Common Law, page 121. The second canto of Byron's Don Juan, published in the summer of 1819, illustrates the attitudes and assumptions of the time. 'Tis thus with people in an open boat. They live upon the love of life and bear more than can be believed or even thought, and stand like rocks the tempest's wear and tear, and hardship still has been the sailor's lot since Noah's Ark went cruising here and there. But man is a carnivorous production, and must have meals at least one meal a day. He cannot live like woodcocks upon suction, but like the shark and tiger must have prey. Although his anatomical construction bears vegetables in a grumbling way, your laboring people think beyond all question beef, veal, and mutton better for digestion. And thus it was with our hapless crew. The most comprehensive treatment of the Nottingham galley is contained in a scholarly edition of Kenneth Roberts's novel Boone Island. I have used Captain Dean's earliest edition of his narrative, published in 1711, reprinted in Donald Wharton's In the Trough of the Sea, Selected American Sea Deliverance Narratives, 1610 to 1766, pages 153 to 155. Edward Leslie's Desperate Journeys, Abandoned Souls, True Stories of Castaways and Other Survivors, contains an excellent discussion of the Nottingham galley wreck, along with other famous incidences of maritime cannibalism, including the Essex disaster. Also, see Chapter 5, The Customs of the Sea, in Simpson's Cannibalism and the Common Law, pages 95 through 145. Christy Turner and Jacqueline Turner's Man Corn, Cannibalism and Violence in the Prehistoric American Southwest, provides a detailed analysis of how much meat an average human would provide, pages 34 to 35, as does Stanley Garn and Walter Block's The Limited Nutritional Value of Cannibalism, in American Anthropologist, page 106. In The Biology of Human Starvation, Ansel Keys et al. Cite autopsies of starvation victims in which adipose tissues contained no cells with fat globules, page 170. They also cite information on the percentage weight losses of the organs of starvation victims, page 190. My thanks to Beth Tarnovish and Tim Lepore for their estimates of the amount of meat and calories the Essex starvation victims would have provided. For a modern-day survivalist's guide to cannibalism, complete with a diagram of a human body indicating the preferred cuts of meat and even a list of recipes, see Shiguro Takada's Contingency Cannibalism, Super Hardcore Survivalism's Dirty Little Secret. According to P. Durenberg et al., in Body Mass Index and Percent Body Fat, a meta-analysis among different ethnic groups in the International Journal of Obesity, blacks have lower body fat for the same body mass index, BMI, compared to Caucasians, pages 1168 to 1169. For accounts of the Donner Party and the increased survival rates of the women relative to the men, See George Stewart's Ordeal by Hunger and Joseph King's Winter of Entrapment. Another example of women outlasting men in a starvation situation is found in Anne Saunders's account of her ordeal after the ship on which she was a passenger, along with only one other woman, became disabled on its way from New Brunswick to Liverpool in 1826. After 22 days in the rigging of the waterlogged ship, the six survivors, all of whom resorted to cannibalism, included the two women passengers. In addition to a physiological advantage, Pollard's age may have given him an attitudinal edge when it came to long-term survival. According to John Leach, those under 25 suffer because they have not yet learned to conserve energies. They have difficulty pacing themselves for the long haul. Passivity does not come naturally to youth. Survival Psychology, page 172. Both Glyn Bennett in Beyond Endurance, pages 205 to 209, and John Leach in Survival Psychology speak of Shackleton's unique ability to embody different leadership styles. According to Leach, Shackleton was a rare man who was capable of both types of leadership. He was clearly a dominant character capable of decisive initial leadership while possessing an incredible degree of perseverance, page 141. Frank Worsley makes the comments concerning Shackleton's sensitivity to his men in Shackleton's Boat Journey, pages 169 to 170. In Biology of Starvation, Keyes provides a summary of the physiological effects of starvation that includes a poor tolerance to cold temperatures and a darkening of the skin, particularly about the face, pages 827 to 828. Brian Simpson, in Cannibalism and the Common Law, tells of the belief that cannibalism, once practiced, easily becomes a habit, page 149. Goetz, Cow, and Bowman speak of how semi-starvation had coarsened the men in the Minnesota experiment, page 32. David Harrison's account of the sufferings aboard the Peggy appears in Donald Wharton's In the Trough of the Sea, pages 259 to 277. Although the sailors claimed that the black slave was picked to be killed by lottery, Captain Harrison had some strong suspicions that the poor Ethiopian was not altogether treated fairly. But on recollection, I almost wondered that they had given him even the appearance of an equal chance with themselves, page 269. Herbert Block describes modern feral communities in The Personality of Inmates of Concentration Camps, page 335. Hilda Bloom in How Did They Survive? Refers to the inmate who spoke of killing his feelings, page 8. Bloom also quotes from the female prisoner who took on a savage cunning in order to survive in the death camps, page 22. While living with the Ihalmiut in the Northwest Territory, Farley Mowat learned the vital importance of fat to a people living on an all-meat diet. In People of the Deer, he writes, an eternal craving for fat is part of the price of living on an all-meat diet, page 85. The first recorded instance of drawing lots in a survival situation at sea was published in 1641. See Simpson's Cannibalism in the Common Law, pages 122 to 123. The description of David Flatt's reaction to his death sentence aboard the Peggy is told by Harrison, Wharton, pages 271 to 276. See also H. Bluestone and C. L. McGahee's Reaction to Extreme Stress, Impending Death by Execution. My thanks to friends Robert Leach and Michael Royston for their insights regarding Quakerism's stand on gambling and killing. Personal Communication, June 3, 1998. Leach also provided me with information regarding the Quaker background of George Pollard. Personal Communication, May 22, 1998. R.B. Forbes, in the pamphlet Loss of the Essex Destroyed by a Whale, refers to how the men aboard the Polly fished for sharks with people's body parts, pages 13 to 14. My account of the drawing of lots and execution of Owen Coffin is based not only on testimonies from Pollard, as recorded by George Bennett in Heffernan, page 215, Chase, and Nickerson, but also on a letter Nickerson wrote to Leon Lewis dated October 27, 1876, at the NHA. In the letter, Nickerson claims that Pollard was Coffin's executioner, which contradicts his own account in the narrative, where he says that it was Ramsdell who shot Coffin. Since other accounts claim it was Ramsdell, I have assumed that Nickerson was mistaken in the letter. Chapter 12, In the Eagle's Shadow. John Leach speaks of the active-passive approach to a long-term survival situation in Survival Psychology, page 167. Eleanor Whitney et al., in Understanding Normal and Clinical Nutrition, describe the effects of an extreme magnesium deficiency. Convulsions, bizarre muscle movements, especially of the eye and facial muscles, hallucinations, and difficulty in swallowing, page 302. Captain Harrison's account of the sailor who died insane after eating the raw liver of a black slave is in Donald Wharton's In the Trough of the Sea, page 269. A version of this story apparently made its way into the lore surrounding the Essex ordeal. In his pamphlet, Loss of the Essex, R.B. Forbes, who depended greatly on information provided by the often unreliable Frederick Sanford, claimed that when a black man died in one of the boats, another one partook of his liver, became mad, and jumped overboard. Page 11. The meaning of Barzillai comes from Alfred Jones's A List of Proper Names in the Old and New Testaments, in Cruden's Complete Concordance, page 791. Warren Kinston and Rachel Rosser write of the psychological effects of suffering high losses in battle in Disaster, Effects on Mental and Physical State, pages 445 to 446. Ansel Keys et al. Discuss what they call the edema problem in The Biology of Human Starvation, pages 935 to 1014. Robert Leach provided me with the information concerning Benjamin Lawrence's Quaker upbringing. Personal Communication, May 22, 1998. Josiah Quincy wrote of his conversation with the financially humbled Captain Lawrence, Benjamin's grandfather, in 1801, recording, "Lawrence had seen better days and had been upon a level in point of property with the principal inhabitants of the island. But misfortunes had beset his old age, and he was just preparing to remove his family to Alexandria." Crosby, page 119. As Leach reveals, Benjamin's father died during a voyage to Alexandria in 1809. Concerning the sailing speed of a whaleboat, Willits Ansell writes in The Whaleboat, 4 to 6 knots was a good average for a boat beating or running over a period of time on a number of headings, page 17. In 1765, the crew of the Peggy watched helplessly as the captain of a potential rescue ship ordered his men to sail away from the disabled craft. Wharton, page 265. As Edward Leslie writes in Desperate Journeys, Abandoned Souls, rescuing castaways entailed risks and offered no tangible rewards. Indeed, taking survivors on board would deplete already limited supplies of food and water, page 218. According to Beth Tarnovish, tapioca pudding is a soft food that would be easy for these starving men to digest. It is high in calories and protein, and high-protein, high-calorie foods are recommended to post-operative surgical patients to promote healing and regain nutrient losses experienced prior to and during surgery. Personal Communication, March 28, 1999. Christy Turner and Jacqueline Turner discuss techniques for extracting marrow from human bones in Man Corn, pages 33 to 38. McDonald Critchley in Shipwreck Survivors, A Medical Study, writes of deliriums among castaways that are shared in actual content, leading to a sort of collective confabulation, page 81. Charles Murphy, third mate on the Dauphin, tells how Pollard's boat was discovered in his 220-stanza poem, published in 1877. Murphy also provides a crew list that indicates the Native Americans who were aboard the Dauphin. For an account of the Indian legend of how the giant Mauchop followed a giant eagle to Nantucket, see my Abram's Eyes, The Native American Legacy of Nantucket Island, page 35. Melville retells a version of this legend in chapter 14 of Moby Dick. Commodore Charles Ridgely of the Constellation recorded the account of how Pollard and Ramsdell were found sucking the bones of their shipmates, Heffernan, page 99. As Heffernan points out, Ridgely would have heard this account from the Nantucketer Obed Starbuck, first mate of the Hero, page 101. A story in the Sydney Gazette, June 9, 1821, claimed that the fingers and other fragments of their deceased companions were in the pockets of the captain and boy when taken on board the whaler. An incomplete photocopy of Aaron Paddock's letter describing Pollard's account of the Essex disaster is in NHA Collection 15, Folder 57. In the letter, Paddock writes, "Captain Pollard, though very low when first taken up, has immediately revived. I regret to say that young Ramsdell has appeared to fail since taken up." Claude Rawson, the Maynard Mack Professor of English at Yale University, spoke to me about the tendency of those who have been reduced to survival cannibalism to speak openly about the experience, often to the horror of their listeners. Personal Communication, November 13, 1998. The loquacity of the 16 survivors of an airplane crash in the Andes in 1972 made possible Piers Paul Reed's now famous account of survival cannibalism, Alive, the Story of the Andes Survivors. Chapter 13, Homecoming. In Stove by a Whale, Thomas Heffernan provides a detailed account of the political situation in Chile at the time of the Essex survivors' arrival in Valparaiso, pages 89 to 91. The NHA Essex Blue File contains a transcript from the National Archives in Chile of the February 25th entry describing the ordeal of Chase, Lawrence, and Nickerson. Nickerson speaks of the acting American consul Henry Hill's efforts on their behalf. Commodore Ridgely's account of the survivors' appearance and their treatment by Dr. Osborne is cited by Heffernan, pages 100 to 101. Ridgely claims that the sailors aboard the Constellation originally offered to donate an entire month's pay to the treatment of the Essex survivors, which would have totaled between $2,000 and $3,000, but realizing that American and English residents of Valparaiso had also created a fund, Ridgely limited his men to a dollar each. Heffernan, page 100. Ansel Keys et al. Tell of the painful process by which the participants in the Minnesota starvation experiment regained the weight they had lost in the Biology of Human Starvation, page 828. Captain Harrison's account of the difficulties he had in regaining use of his digestive tract are described in his narrative of the Peggy disaster, Wharton, page 275. Nickerson provides a detailed account of the troubles the hero ran into off St. Mary's Island. Also, see my Away Offshore, pages 161 to 162. My description of how Pollard and Ramsdell made their way to Valparaiso is indebted to Heffernan's Stove by a Whale, pages 95 to 109, as is my account of the rescue of the three men on Henderson Island, pages 109 to 115. Brian Simpson writes of gastronomic incest in Cannibalism and the Common Law, page 141. Chapel tells of their travails on Henderson in a pamphlet titled Loss of the Essex, reprinted in Heffernan, pages 218 to 224. Nickerson talked to Seth Weeks about his time on the island, and Weeks confirmed that the freshwater spring never again appeared above the tide line. According to the oceanographer James McKenna, it is more than likely that an exceptionally high and low spring tide, combined with other factors such as the phase of the moon and variations in the orbital patterns of the sun and moon, were what gave the Essex crew temporary access to the spring in late December of 1820. Personal Communication, May 10, 1999. Captain Beachy writes of the missing Essex boat, "The third boat was never heard of, but it is not improbable that the wreck of a boat and four skeletons which were seen on Ducey's Island by a merchant vessel were her remains and that of her crew." In Narrative, Volume 1, pages 59 to 61. Heffernan, who cites the Beachy reference, doubts that the whaleboat referred to could have belonged to the Essex. Stove by a Whale, page 88. Obed Macy's account of what happened on Nantucket during the winter and spring of 1821 are in the third volume of his journals in NHA Collection 96. Frederick Sanford's description of the letter regarding the Essex survivors being read in front of the post office in a public way is in a brief article titled Whale Stories that apparently appeared in an off-island newspaper in or around 1872. An undated copy of the article is on file at the NHA. My thanks to Elizabeth Oldham for bringing the story to my attention. Sanford also includes a somewhat overheated account of the whale attack. A large whale, sperm, came upon the ship, and with such violence as to make her heel and shake like an aspen leaf. The whale glanced off to windward, and when 2 miles to windward turned and came down upon the ship and struck her a most deadly blow on the bows, which caused her to heel over and to fill and sink. The New Bedford Mercury, June 15, 1821, includes two stories about the Essex. The first comes from a Captain Wood of the Triton, who had heard about the disaster from Captain Paddock of the Diana and reports that Pollard and Ramsdell had been picked up by the Dauphin. The second story tells of a letter just received from Nantucket reporting on the arrival of the Eagle, with Chase, Lawrence, Nickerson, and Ramsdell as passengers. Nantucket's own paper, The Inquirer, did not begin publication until June 23, 1821, almost 2 weeks after the arrival of the first group of Essex survivors. The letter describing Chase's inability to speak about the disaster is dated June 17, 1821, and is the possession of Rosemary Heeman, a descendant of Barnabas Sears, to whom the letter was addressed. My thanks to Mrs. Heeman for bringing the letter to my attention. Mention of Pollard's reception is limited to a single sentence. Captain Pollard, late master of the ship Essex, arrived here and the two brothers last Sunday, August 9, 1821. Frederick Sanford's account of Pollard's arrival is in Gustave Courbet's The Perils and Romance of Whaling, The Century Magazine, August 1890, page 521. He also writes of Pollard's return to Nantucket in The Inquirer, March 28, 1879. Although many writers have mistakenly attributed Sanford's account of a silent reception to the arrival of Chase and company, it was Pollard's return that elicited this response. The description of a Nantucketer's reaction to the arrival of a whale ship is from the Nantucket Inquirer, May 14, 1842. Lance Davis et al. Speak of the greater responsibilities and pay of a whaling captain compared to a merchant captain, in Pursuit of Leviathan, pages 175 to 185. Amasa Delano's memories of his return after an unsuccessful voyage are in his Narrative of Voyages and Travels, pages 252 to 253. Edward Stackpole writes of Owen Coffin's grandfather Hezekiah and his involvement in the Boston Tea Party in Whales and Destiny, page 38. Robert Leach provided me with information regarding the Coffin family and the Friends meeting, personal communication, May 20, 1998. Thomas Nickerson's account of Nancy Coffin's response to George Pollard is in his letter to Leon Lewis. Piers Paul Reed speaks of the Montevideo Archbishop's judgment of the Andes survivors in Alive, page 308. Another Catholic official did insist, however, that contrary to the claims of one of the Andes survivors, the eating of human flesh under these circumstances was not equivalent to Holy Communion, page 309. Documents relating to the rise of Quakerism on Nantucket mention a religious discussion that makes an intriguing reference to cannibalism and communion. In the spring of 1698, several years before Quakerism took hold on the island, an itinerant friend named Thomas Chalkley visited Nantucket and recorded his conversation with one of the community's first settlers, Stephen Hussey. Hussey had once lived in the Barbados, where he had heard a Quaker claim that we must eat the spiritual flesh and drink the spiritual blood of Christ. Hussey asked, "Is it not a contradiction in nature that flesh and blood should be spiritual?" When Chalkley pointed out that Christ had been speaking figuratively when he told the apostles, "Except ye eat my flesh and drink my blood, ye have no life in you," Hussey indignantly replied, "I don't think they were to gnaw it from his arms and shoulders." Starbuck, History of Nantucket, page 518. One can only wonder how Chalkley and Hussey would have responded to the all-too-literal story of the Essex. Claude Rawson refers to cannibalism as a cultural embarrassment in a review of Brian Simpson's Cannibalism and the Common Law in the London Review of Books, January 24, 1985, page 21. Concerning survivors who have resorted to cannibalism, John Leach writes, "If it can be accepted, justified, or in cases rationalized, then the act of enforced cannibalism can be accommodated with little or no psychological dysfunction." Survival Psychology, page 98. Thomas Heffernan has pointed out the similarities between Chase's account of what happened on Pollard's and Joy's boat and what is described in Aaron Paddock's letter, Stove by a Whale, page 231. Herman Melville wrote about Owen Chase's authorship of his narrative in the back pages of his own copy of the book. See Northwestern Newbery Moby Dick, page 984. Yet another aspect of the disaster not mentioned by Chase is whether he ever followed Richard Peterson's dying wishes and contacted the sailor's widow in New York. The family of William Coffin Jr. had something of a tradition of writing controversial publications. 5 years earlier, his father, who 20 years before had been wrongly accused by the island's Quaker hierarchy of robbing the Nantucket Bank, wrote an eloquent defense that proved the crime had been committed by off-islanders. See my Away Offshore, pages 156 to 159. I also speak of William Coffin Jr.'s qualifications as ghostwriter of Chase's narrative in Away Offshore, pages 158 and 249. The statement regarding William Coffin's enthusiastic love of literature appeared in an obituary in the Nantucket Inquirer, May 2, 1838. An announcement concerning the publication of Chase's narrative appeared in the Inquirer, November 22, 1821. Melville recorded having heard of a narrative by Captain Pollard in the back pages of his copy of Chase's book, Northwestern Newbery Moby Dick, page 985. Ralph Waldo Emerson's remarks concerning the Nantucketer's sensitivity to everything that dishonors the island appears in his 1847 journal entries about the island, page 63. In 1822, an anonymous letter would appear in a Boston paper questioning the religious character of the island's inhabitants. An irate Nantucketer responded in words that might have been applied to Owen Chase. "We have a spy amongst us who, like other spies, sends abroad his cowardly reports where he thinks they can never be disproved." Nantucket Inquirer, April 18, 1822. According to Alexander Starbuck's list of whaling voyages in the history of Nantucket, the two brothers left Nantucket on November 26, 1821. Nickerson speaks of being a part of the two brothers' crew, along with Charles Ramsdell, in a poem titled The Ship, Two Brothers, NHA Collection 106, Folder 3.5. Chapter 14. Consequences. My account of the two brothers' last voyage is based primarily on Nickerson's poem, The Ship, Two Brothers, and his prose narrative, Loss of the Ship, Two Brothers of Nantucket, both previously unpublished and in NHA Collection 106, Folder 3.5. The first mate of the two brothers, Eben Gardner, also left an account of the wreck, which is at the NHA. Charles Wilkes, the midshipman on the Water Witch, who recorded his conversation with George Pollard, would become the leader of the United States exploring expedition. As Heffernan points out, there is the possibility that Wilkes also met Owen Chase in 1839, when four of the expedition's ships, along with the Charles Carroll, were anchored for several weeks at Tahiti, pages 130 to 131. Wilkes's account of his meeting with Captain Pollard is included in Autobiography of Rear Admiral Charles Wilkes, U.S. Navy, 1798 to 1877, and is quoted at length in Heffernan, pages 146 to 148. Edward Stackpole tells of Frederick Coffin's discovery of the Japan ground in The Sea Hunters, page 268. Not all whaling scholars are convinced that Coffin was the first to find the whaling ground. George Pollard may have been taught how to perform a lunar observation by the two brothers' former captain, George Worth, during the 2.5-month cruise back to Nantucket from Valparaiso in the spring and summer of 1821. Although both Pollard and Captain Pease of the Martha were convinced that they had run into an uncharted shoal, Nickerson reveals in his letter to Leon Lewis that both he and the Martha's first mate, Thomas Derrick, believed it to be French Frigate Shoal, an already well-known hazard to the west of the Hawaiian Islands. George Bennett's account of his meeting with George Pollard originally appeared in Journal of Voyages and Travels by the Reverend Daniel Tyerman and George Bennett, Esquire, deputed from the London Missionary Society. Concerning a character based on Pollard, Melville writes in the poem Clerrell, "A Jonah is he, and men bruit the story. None will give him place in a third venture." Nickerson tells of Pollard's single voyage in the merchant service in his Loss of the Ship Two Brothers of Nantucket. The rumor about George Pollard's switching lots with Owen Coffin is recorded by Cyrus Townsend Brady in The Yarn of the Essex Whaler in Cosmopolitan, November 1904, page 72. Brady wrote that even though the tradition was still current in Nantucket, he doubted its veracity. My thanks to Diana Brown, granddaughter of Joseph Warren Finney, for providing me with a copy of the relevant portions of the original transcript of Finney's reminiscences, recorded by his daughter, Ruth Pierce. Ms. Brown has published a selection of her grandfather's reminiscences under the title Nantucket, Far Away and Long Ago, in Historic Nantucket, pages 23 to 30. In a personal communication, August 9, 1998, she explains Finney's relation to Captain Pollard. Captain Warren Finney, his father, married Valina Worth, the daughter of Joseph T. Worth and Sophronia Riddell, June 6, 1834. Sophronia Riddell was, I believe, the sister of Mary Riddell, who married Captain Pollard. After bearing three daughters, she died in 1843. Shortly after that, he was married to Henrietta Smith, who died the end of 1845, the year Joseph Warren was born. His father died about 5 years after this in a ship disaster on one of the Great Lakes, so he was then brought up by his grandmother and grandfather Smith. He, of course, was not a blood relative to the Pollards, but they were part of his extended family. The rumor about George Pollard's making light of having eaten Owen Coffin is recorded in Horace Beck's Folklore and the Sea, page 379. As late as the 1960s, the tradition was still being repeated on Nantucket. My thanks to Thomas McGlynn, who attended school on the island, for sharing with me his memory of the Pollard anecdote. What is known about Owen Chase's life after the Essex disaster is recounted by Heffernan in Stove by a Whale, pages 119 to 145. Emerson recorded his conversation with the sailor about the White Whale and the Winslow/Essex on February 19, 1834, Journals, Volume 4, page 265. Melville's memories of meeting Chase's son and seeing Chase himself are in the back pages of his copy of the Essex narrative, Northwestern Newbery Moby Dick, pages 981 to 983. Although Melville did apparently meet Owen Chase's son, he went to sea after Owen had retired as a whaling captain and mistook someone else for the former first mate of the Essex. Even if Melville didn't actually see Chase, he thought he did, and it would be Melville's sensibility that would largely determine how future generations viewed the Essex disaster, through the lens of Moby Dick. Melville's remarks concerning Chase's learning of his wife's infidelity are also recorded in his copy of the narrative, Northwestern Newbery Moby Dick, page 995. In Loss of the Ship Two Brothers of Nantucket, Nickerson tells of what happened after the crew was taken to Oahu on the Martha. All of the crew of the two brothers were safely landed, and as the whaling fleet were at the time in that port, each took their own course and joined separate ships as chances offered. Heffernan speaks of Ramsdell's being captain of the General Jackson in Stove by a Whale, page 152. The computerized genealogical records at the NHA show that Ramsdell's first wife, Mercy Fisher, bore four children and died in 1846, and that his second wife, Eliza Lamb, had two children. The Brooklyn City Directory lists a Thomas G. Nickerson, shipmaster, living on 293 Hughes as late as 1872. Benjamin Lawrence's obituary appeared in the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, April 5, 1879. Nickerson writes in his narrative about the fates of William Wright and Thomas Chappell. Seth Weeks's obituary appeared in the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, September 24, 1887. It concludes, "He became blind for some years past and ended his life in sweet peace and quiet among his own people, always highly respected and honored." Edward Stackpole recounts the anecdote about Nantucketers not talking about the Essex in Aftermath, in the NHA edition of Nickerson's narrative, page 78. For an account of the island's reputation as a Quaker abolitionist stronghold, see my Every Wave is a Fortune, Nantucket Island and the Making of an American Icon. Whittier writes about Nantucket in his ballad, The Exiles, about Thomas Macy's voyage to the island in 1659. I discuss the success of the almost all-black crew of the Loper in A Way Offshore, pages 162 to 163. Frederick Douglass ends the first edition of the narrative of his life with his speech at the Nantucket Athenaeum. Thomas Heffernan traces the literary uses of the Essex story in his chapter, Telling the Story, pages 155 to 182. The author of an article in the Garrettsville, Ohio Journal, September 3, 1896, about the return of the Essex trunk to Nantucket, provides convincing evidence of the impact the Essex story had on America's young people. In McGuffey's old Eclectic Fourth Reader, we used to read that account. It told about whalers being in open whaleboats 2,000 miles from land. Such accounts as that make impressions on the minds of children, which last. Testifying to how far the story of the Essex spread is a ballad titled The Shipwreck of the Essex, recorded in Cornwall, England. The ballad takes many liberties with the facts of the disaster, claiming, for example, that lots were cast no less than 8 times while the men were still on Ducie Island, in Simpson's Cannibalism and the Common Law, pages 316 to 317. Emerson's letter to his daughter about the Essex is in his Collected Letters, edited by Ralph Rusk, volume 3, pages 398 to 399. On Melville's one and only visit to Nantucket, see Susan Beagle's Herman Melville, Nantucket's First Tourist. Melville recorded his impressions of George Pollard in the pages of Chase's Narrative, Northwestern Newbery Moby Dick, pages 987 to 988. On Nantucket's decline as a whaling port and the Great Fire of 1846, see my Away Offshore, pages 195 to 198, 203 to 204, and 209 to 210. Christopher Hussey, in Talks About Old Nantucket, writes about how the burning slick of oil surrounded the firefighters in the shallows of the harbor, page 61. See also William C. Macy's excellent account of the fire in Part 3 of Obed Macy's History of Nantucket, pages 287 to 289. Concerning the Oak, Nantucket's last whaling vessel, Alexander Starbuck writes, "Sold at Panama, 1872. Sent home 60 barrels sperm, 450 barrels right whale. Nantucket's last whaler," page 483. The statistics concerning the number of sperm whales killed in the 19th and 20th centuries are from Dale Rice's Sperm Whale, page 191. See also Davis et al.'s In Pursuit of Leviathan, page 135, and Hal Whitehead's The Behavior of Mature Male Sperm Whales on the Galapagos Islands Breeding Grounds, page 696. Charles Wilkes, the same man who, as a midshipman, talked with George Pollard, recorded the observation that sperm whales had become wilder in Volume 5 of Narrative of the United States Exploring Expedition, page 493. Alexander Starbuck collected accounts of whale attacks on ships in History of the American Whale Fishery, pages 114 to 125. Captain de Blois's description of his encounter with the whale that sank the Anne Alexander is in Clement Sawtelle's The Ship, Anne Alexander of New Bedford, 1805 to 1851, pages 61 to 84. Melville speaks of the Anne Alexander whale in a letter dated November 7, 1851, to Everett Dykink in his Correspondence, pages 139 to 140. In a letter dated November 15, 1868, to Winifred Batty, Phoebe Chase tells of seeing Owen Chase. "He called me Cousin Susan, taking me for Sister Worth, held my hand and sobbed like a child, saying, 'Oh, my head, my head!' It was pitiful to see the strong man bowed, then his personal appearance so changed, didn't allow himself decent clothing, fears he shall come to want." NHA Collection 105, Folder 15. For information concerning Nickerson, see Edward Stackpole's foreword to the NHA edition of Nickerson's Narrative, pages 8 to 11. My thanks to Amy Newell, curator of collections at the NHA, for providing me with information about Benjamin Lawrence's Circle of Twine and the Essex Chest. See A Relic of the Whaleship Essex in the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, August 22, 1986, and A Valuable Relic Preserved in the Garrettsville Journal, September 3, 1896. Epilogue. Bones. Information on the sperm whale that washed up on Nantucket at the end of 1997 comes from the following sources. Articles by Dionys Gauvin and Chris Warner in the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, January 8, 1998. Articles by J.C. Gamble in the Nantucket Beacon, January 6, 1998. The Story of Nantucket's Sperm Whale by Cecil Baron Jensen in Historic Nantucket, Summer 1998, pages 5 to 8. And interviews conducted in May and June of 1999 with Edie Ray, Tracy Plaut, Tracy Sundell, Jeremy Slavitz, Rick Morecambe, and Dr. Carlene Ketten. Dr. Wesley Tiffany, director of the University of Massachusetts Boston Field Station, spoke with me about erosion at Codfish Park. Personal Communication, June 1999. The whale necropsy was supervised by Connie Marigo and Howard Crum of the New England Aquarium. The cutting up of the whale was directed by Tom French of the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. Working with French were David Taylor, a science teacher at Triton Regional High School in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and three of Taylor's students. It was fitting that Taylor and his students were from Newburyport, which was where many of Nantucket's first settlers had come from in the 17th century. The Nantucket Historical Association was officially granted the whale skeleton by the National Marine Fisheries Service in the winter of 1998. According to Clay Lancaster's Holiday Island, Thomas Nickerson operated a guest house on North Water Street in the mid-1870s, when he met the writer Leon Lewis, but had relocated to North Street, now Cliff Road, by 1882, page 55. An advertisement in the Enquirer and Mirror, June 26, 1875, announces Nickerson's having opened a family boarding house with several large, airy, and commodious rooms with all the comforts of a home. My thanks to Elizabeth Oldham for bringing this ad to my attention.
This is Scott Brick. We hope that you've enjoyed this unabridged production of In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex by Nathaniel Philbrick. This program was produced and directed by Dan Musselman, executive producer Patty Peruse. In the Heart of the Sea is a production of Penguin Random House Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA LLC, a Penguin Random House company. Copyright 2000. Text copyright 2000 by Nathaniel Philbrick. All rights reserved.